When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PML.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I would be very careful with manslinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Are we going legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
I'm the captain now. No Steve Palazzolo in the building. So Sam Monson hosting and Brad Spielberger, our resident cap guru and free agent expert, is going to come join us and help preview free agency, which obviously comes up before the draft. How's it going, Brad?
Doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Before we get into it, we're going to tell you a little bit about our friends at Western Southern who power this great studio and make this entire thing absolutely possible. So the PFF NFL podcast is brought to you by Western and Southern Financial Group. While you focus on your roster moves, Western and Southern helps advance your money moves. Buying your first home, planning to start a family, wondering how to make your money grow, Western and Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions helps you rest assured on game day. Team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. That's westernsouthern.com/PFF. If you support this podcast, if you like us to do well, there is nothing more you could do for us than go to that link, check out what they offer, and help us out. So, Bradley, this was an episode that did really well last year. A lot of people are incredibly interested in free agency. All the talk right now is obviously about the draft. But before that, we get the kind of pro part of, you know, the team building and roster construction stage of the offseason. So for this one, obviously, we're going to do a little free agent class overview, where it's strong, where it's weak. But I also want to do a couple of other things, figure out who's actually in position to spend. You know, we've been talking about that a little bit with our Fixing Every Team series over the last couple of episodes. Which teams are scheduled to lose a bunch of their own players, because that's kind of the first starting point. And also cast our eye back a little bit to last year and figure out who did well, who did badly when it came to spending the money a year ago. So, sound good?
Sounds great.
All right, let's start off with the salary cap this year. It's jumped again. We're back to this standard world of increases every year. The number's only getting higher. There's presumably more money to be spent, et cetera, et cetera. How big a jump is it this year? And does that mean that we're going to see more spending?
8% growth this year, $225 million. Definitely a big jump. And I will say you're also going to see a lot of aggressive spending, because the true quantum leap, potentially, the NFL likes to smooth it out. But when the TV money hits, the gambling money hits, all those things, that should be next year. And so teams that know that and realize, hey, players are going to ask for a lot more, agents are going to ask for a lot more in this new construct of, if it really does take that jump, let's spend now and get guys signed to multi-year deals before they're then pointing to that and saying, you know, now we want this plus X percentage. And so I think we are going to see a lot of teams spend a good amount this offseason.
Presumably players and agents know that as well. Are they like angling for contracts that have some kind of jump up next year? Like, we'll sign now, but we understand this money is coming in a year's time, so let's have a contract that reflects that.
I think realistically, you're just going to see shorter term or a push for shorter term from these agents. And that's already been a trend across positions, across the league. Obviously, they always want to get back to the market faster. So maybe we'll see some guys that, you know, take a 2-year deal, which realistically can be 1 year and then an extension, or maybe it's even take those 1-year flyers and bet on themselves wanting to hit the market again. So I think that'll be the bigger push, is just making sure you're back on that market as fast as possible.
All right, so we've been talking about this free agent group as a weak class across the board. Are we doing it a disservice, or does it actually look as bad as it, or is it actually as bad as it looks?
You know what's funny is that, look, it's not a great class. I'm not going to sit here and say it's this awesome class, but as a result, I think unlike last year where we probably came on and talked about how awesome it was and then 8 of the 10 guys we talked about got franchise tagged,
right.
I don't think that's going to be the case here. So the actual available players I think might stack up. Look, De'Ron Payne is probably going to get franchise tagged by Washington, maybe the prize, you know, potential free agent signing of the class. But outside of that, you look at some of the other guys in our top 10, top 20, and I think they're going to hit the market. So that's how I would couch it. And then you also mentioned, you know, everyone, of course, I get why we love the draft. It's the mystery box. You know, we don't know what they could be, so we just assume they're all going to be the next great player. The draft and the free agency are one and the same, right? Teams are not doing these in a vacuum. They're connected. They're correlated. So if you want to know what your teams are doing or what the NFL, you know, at large is doing in the draft, look at the free agency and what the teams do and how they prioritize positions or spending. That can give you a really good idea of what you're going to expect come late April.
Without going off on a massive tangent about this, I've seen it talked about before, suggested that the NFL should sort of logically flip the sequence of free agency in the draft and do the draft first, let everybody select the college players, and then open up the spending and have everybody, you know, fill in the gaps of the roster once they know what they're actually dealing with all these college players signed. Do you think that's a good thing? And if so, is there any earthly chance that this ever occurs?
It wouldn't be a good thing for the veteran players trying to get contracts. So I think that's why you're probably never going to see it. The union, at least in my opinion, would not want to agree to something like that. Realistically, if you can, you know, hey, you have a glaring need at this position. You don't know what you're going to be able to get in the draft. So you should pay me and not take that risk that you miss out on this prospect you're super high on. You know, I think we'd agree. Outside of the first two rounds also, you probably shouldn't be looking to add a guy, or in your mind think you're adding a guy that's going to make a substantial impact in that following year anyway. So, yeah, long answer short, no, because the veterans, yeah, I think that would be bad news for them trying to get deals.
Yeah, it sort of feels like 50-50 to me. It fixes some things, but in a way, well-run teams right now, it's not really a problem. Like, the smart teams don't run into the draft looking to fill, you know, three starting positions or whatever. They get the money, or they get the deals done, they fill the spots that they have open in free agency, and then they roll in the draft, basically enabling them to pick best player available, to future-proof the roster, to look for depth, to look for guys that are going to be contributors next year. So there's no real benefit to those teams because they're kind of doing that anyway. And the other teams, you know, who cares?
Yeah, that's a whole separate issue. But yeah, no, you really shouldn't, like I said, I mean, outside of the top 50 picks, even those guys, there's no guarantee they're going to be a contributor right away. So for me, free agency is about addressing needs. And if you do that, then you can truly go, you know, the buzzword of best player available. Obviously, they still have some positional focus in mind, but you can do that to the best of your ability if you've taken care and addressed those spots on your roster in free agency.
So the franchise tag thing is a good thing to bring up, because every time free agency starts to be talked about, you sort of have to be aware that, okay, but a lot of these top names are never going to hit the open market. You know, teams are going to franchise tag them. They're going to re-sign. They're never actually going to be free agents. And it's pretty clear quite early how many of those guys you're going to lose. It is interesting this year that there seems to be fewer of those guys. So how many current schedule free agents do you think are actually going to receive the franchise tag?
Yeah, so I would say I think a second one for Orlando Brown in Kansas City is possible, if not probable. I think, like I said, De'Ron Payne, I think, is now a foregone conclusion. I think we'll see the running backs, you know, Josh Jacobs, maybe Saquon Barkley. But frankly, at this point, I think the Giants are going to have to save it for Daniel Jones. But I could see Jacobs. Outside of that, I mean, there's no, like, super, super obvious you know, potential choices there. Maybe a second one for Dalton Schultz in Dallas, or they maybe even give it to Tony Pollard based on how his injury looks. But, you know, we're talking about like trench players. Like, I think a lot of the right tackles, Mike McGlinchey, Caleb McGarry, Juwan Taylor, I think they get out. You know, you look at some of the more premium positions, edge defender, Marcus Davenport is not going to get franchised. Actually can't now get franchise tagged in New Orleans because of a contract reworking I won't get into, but you know, not even eligible anymore. So I think it's going to be a low number, and these guys are going to be available for teams to bid on.
What about the two quarterbacks that are right at the top? We've got Lamar Jackson, obviously, with this contract dragging out and the impasse they appear to be in, and then Seattle with the decision they have to make with Geno Smith one way or the other. What are those two deals going to look like, or where are they in terms of franchise tag versus long-term deal versus see ya, we're going to go in a different direction?
Yeah, Lamar will be tagged 110% by, you know, March 7th, which is the deadline. We're actually in the window right now. It opened on the 21st. He will get tagged because it sounds like they're just nowhere near close to a long-term deal, and they'll try to buy themselves more time before July 15th, which is the deadline to sign a franchise tag player to a multi-year deal. With Geno, it sounds like negotiations are going really well there. But again, obviously, if they're not done and you don't want to risk losing that player, letting him test his availability on the open market, you'll place the tag there as well. So Lamar, 100%. I would say Geno, it's probably still likely unless they can get, you know, because it's going to be still maybe a nine-figure deal. You don't want to rush into that and try to get it done in 2 weeks just to avoid the tag. So I could see both guys getting it because Seattle has no one else they need to use it on.
We had this whole debate already with the Fixing the Team episodes. I'm curious about your take, though. As far as I see it, there are kind of three outcomes for Lamar Jackson. Number one, they end up getting a long-term deal done. Everybody's happy. We move on. Number two, they can't get a deal done. They place a franchise tag on him. And then from there, you have a fork in the road. You either tag him to trade him away based off whatever offers come in, or you tag him and he plays on the franchise tag because Baltimore is not prepared to give him the kind of guarantees that he seems to be demanding or that he would reasonably want. So they're basically at an impasse. Which of those three outcomes, and obviously, you know, as you mentioned, you can tag just to give you room, negotiating time to get the long-term deal done. But which of those three outcomes do you think is most likely for Lamar heading into this season?
So we will have a little bit of a tell based on what tag they use, whether it's the non-exclusive tag or the exclusive tag. I would say there's a 99% chance it's the exclusive tag, which, you know, the main difference for people to know is with the non-exclusive, other teams could then sign him to an offer sheet. The Ravens could then either match or get two first-round picks. I think we'd all agree Lamar is worth more than that. So I'm guessing they go exclusive tag, and he can't negotiate with anyone else. I honestly still think, though, that a trade is fairly likely because I just don't see them bridging this gap on the fully guaranteed money. But if I had to place a bet on it, I would say he gets signed to an exclusive tag and plays in Baltimore in 2023 on that exclusive tag. I just, as of right now, a multi-year deal getting done this offseason just does not seem very likely from my perspective.
Like, obviously, Lamar Jackson's been an incredible player, MVP, all those kinds of things, but it does feel like Baltimore's concerns, or like the reasons that they wouldn't want to go to the giant fully guaranteed contract, are pretty reasonable, right? Like two back-to-back seasons where he's had significant time missed. We've got a guy that's only ever played in sort of one hyper-specific offense that doesn't really exist anywhere else in the league, and how he's going to do in a different system is a kind of question mark. How many other teams are out there going, yeah, we don't care. Like, we're happy. All of the concerns Baltimore have are ridiculous. We're prepared to give him that money and trade upwards of two first-round picks for the privilege of doing the thing that Baltimore doesn't want to do in the first place.
And that's the thing. And look, I do think there are a couple teams that are desperate enough to consider it. I think Atlanta probably would do it. Arthur Blank likes giving blank checks. You know, it's a fitting last name for him there. I think the New York teams, both of them, would at least consider it. Obviously, Daniel Jones, that whole situation, you know, complicates matters there. But right, I mean, when you also then add in the draft capital as well, it's such a massive, massive expenditure that you have to think, okay, we don't need to add much to this roster beyond him. Like, we think we are a team that can win right now because you're not going to have draft capital. If you do go that fully guaranteed route, it's going to be hard to spend around it, both for a cash and cap reasons. But, yeah, there are enough desperate teams. And, look, Baltimore is not desperate. They're a great franchise, one of the best run teams in the NFL. And so they don't have that position. But other teams, they do.
Is it also the kind of move that one of these teams that just sort of sees how huge the task in front of them is would make? So, the Jets, any quarterback effectively upgrades the Jets. On the other hand, they're in a division with Buffalo, Miami, New England. They're in the conference with the AFC and all that gauntlet of quarterbacks you're going to have to get past if you're in the playoffs. If you're the Jets, and I know, they've apparently been whining and dining Derek Carr and telling him how great he's going to be and all that kind of thing. But, you plunk Derek Carr in that roster and you're like, does that really do anything? Sure, we make the playoffs, but is there any chance in the world that Derek Carr goes on a run and knocks off Joe Burrow, Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, in sequence in the playoffs? I would say almost none. But Lamar Jackson, now all of a sudden you have something that actually rivals those guys. Is that the kind of move that a team like the Jets or maybe the Raiders in that division, a similar story? What does good get you? You actually need something great at the position.
That's the perfect example, right? Where they also, look, between what they spent on Sam Darnold to trade up and go get him, and then Zach Wilson, they basically already, made that level of expenditure, and it gave them absolutely nothing in return on both players. So the money's different. Obviously, his contract would be way bigger than a rookie deal, but we talk about the teams that have done different things. Indy probably wouldn't be interested. They've already failed the veteran route multiple times. But if you're the Jets, yeah, you have that incredible, good young defense. Yes, Quinton Williams is about to get a monster new deal, but a lot of those guys should be under contract for a while. I think Lamar with Garrett Wilson and Elijah Moore would have his best receiver duo he's ever had in his career, and the offensive line needs to get healthy, but is a solid unit or has solid pieces if they can get healthy. So, yeah, that's like you said, if you're trying to beat Buffalo, maybe beat a revamped Patriots team, beat a Miami team that obviously is always going to be in the mix now, you got to go big. Yeah, Derek Carr, like you said, you're a playoff team, but is that your goal to make the wild card round and maybe win a game? Is that really worth kind of going all out? Whereas you could, truly go all out and go after Lamar.
All right, let's talk about teams that are scheduled to kind of lose the most of their own players to free agency, or the teams that aren't going to lose much to free agency. Because this, it felt like when we've been going through the free agent class this year and the rosters of each individual team, kind of looking where they need to fix things in the offseason, there seems to be quite a lot of teams that are actually in a pretty good spot in terms of starters leaving, just amount of talent walking out the door. Have teams suddenly started to get really good at this, or we just hit a weird year where all of a sudden there aren't that many guys the teams are actually letting leave?
Yeah, I think it is just that. For some positions like wide receiver, obviously, there should have been or there could have been, one of the greatest free agent classes ever, but they all got extended, right? So I do think you're seeing more and more teams go towards the early extension route. You're always going to have a couple like our hometown Cincinnati Bengals and a couple others that just don't really want to do that. But even teams like Pittsburgh have kind of ponied up and started doing it now. Other clubs that have really pushed back on it. Because, frankly, we talk about a copycat league and that stuff all the time. The Eagles being in the Super Bowl, we can talk about, I'm sure we'll get into it, some great signings they made, great trades, yada, yada. Signing their homegrown quality talent to early extensions is honestly a huge reason why they were able to do what they did this year. When you're paying Josh Sweat $14 million a year, Jordan Mailata $16 million a year, that's how you go get a Hassan Reddick and so on and so forth. So I do think it's a trend to a degree. But, yeah, there are a couple teams. The one that jumps off the page, and it's not even just Tom Brady, but the Buccaneers are losing the fourth most snaps played by pending free agents. And the valuation we put on those players is by far the most in the NFL. They are going to get poached this offseason, and it's going to be a new-look team in a lot of ways in Tampa Bay next year.
So with that in mind, are they in a full rebuild type of mode, or are they going to try and do some kind of patch job on this and just throw an adequate quarterback on it because that division is wide open? They're not going to be terrible even with these losses. They still feel that they can do something next year.
They should tear it down, and these teams, again, we talk about not getting into cap conversation, but when you do push all your cap down the road and try to go all in with a guy like Tom Brady, cool. Why would you not do that? The Saints with Drew Brees, cool. Right. Why would you not do that? For some reason, they then fall into this trap of, let's keep doing that because we have these good players and we have this core. You know, let's bring in Jameis Winston and A. Dalton and do the same thing. If you're the Bucks, you know, maybe let's go after like a Baker Mayfield or, you know, a Derek Carr, whoever comes available. You know, I saw they said Kyle Trask going to play today. I would bet money he does not. But like, they should tear it all down. They're not – I'd be surprised if they do. I think they're going to sell themselves on, look, we paid Chris Godwin. We have Mike Evans. We have Tristan Wirfs, you know, so on and so forth. So they're not going to tear it down, but realistically, they probably should.
You can see the temptation, though. Like, they get the quarterback. They know that guy's capable of winning a Super Bowl. So you go whatever that version of all-in looks like. You assemble the best team around him as humanly possible. And then when he leaves, you sort of look at the thing and you're like, well, this is a really good team. Like, you can't just tear it down from here. Like, this team can win games, can make the playoffs. And then once you make the playoffs, all bets are off. So you can really understand the temptation to be like, well, let's just plug an average starter in there. See if we can make the playoffs. See if we can catch the upside of variance. Whereas you're right, realistically, once the Hall of Fame quarterback departs, the entire reason for having the team like no longer exists. You need to tear it all down and go find another one of those guys because with the best will in the world, you know, the Derek Carrs, the Andy Daltons, the Jameis Winstons of the world are almost certainly not winning a Super Bowl anymore.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's tough when you're in the NFC South to probably tell yourselves, you know, they probably say, hey, we bring in Derek Carr, we're winning this division. Yeah, you're probably right, but, like, does that really matter? You won the division with a sub-500 record last year. Right. So, but I do think that factors in as well. You know, these guys want to win. They have that mentality. They don't believe in these things. I get why. But if you wanted – we talk about, look, if you want a path back to being a competitive team – do that. If you want a path back to being a contender, you should tear this thing down to the skids.
I think, by the way, that's one of the reasons why, like, anytime you sort of bring stuff like that up, like right now, you need an elite quarterback to win a Super Bowl, right? And one of the obvious, the guy that everybody will bring up is Trent Dilfer. In fact, it just hit the chat right now. Flip. Trent Dilfer won a Super Bowl. Okay, number one, Trent Dilfer won a Super Bowl on the back of the greatest defense the game has ever seen. So park that part. But number two, like, the thing I think unremarked upon about that particular sort of period of Trent Dilfer, you know, Brad Johnson, there was a weird area of the NFL where we like lost a block of Hall of Fame quarterbacks. And then there was like a lull of a few years where they didn't really get replaced until they got the next block of Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. There was this small window of time where there actually wasn't that many amazing elite quarterbacks in the NFL. And if you did assemble a really good team, you could win a Super Bowl with Trent Dilfer or Brad Johnson or whoever. That's not the landscape anymore. Like, those guys, even with an all-time great defense, is that getting past not just Patrick Mahomes, but Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, Joe Burrow, Justin Herbert, Trevor Lawrence in sequence? Like, you have to knock off those guys, at least three of them, in order to get to the Super Bowl and win. Like, I'm not sure that's possible anymore.
Not only are we back in an era where we have some good young quarterbacks, I mean, Patrick Mahomes was the oldest starting quarterback in the AFC this year, which is just a laughable note, but also the game is different. I mean, Trent Dilfer himself talking about how he's not impressed with actual good quarterbacks like Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady. Look, but his point also applies. Like, yes, you can't grab receivers. Yes, you can't do things on defense that you used to be able to do, which is why you can no longer, you know, the adage, defense wins championships. Also, real quick, Bears fan, the Bears defense is better than the Ravens defense. Heyo. But but you can't, that's not a thing anymore. Like, that's not how you win in today's NFL. You win by outscoring your opponent. And yes, you still want to have a good defense. I don't believe, like, defense doesn't matter. All that stuff's stupid. You want to have a solid defense. But in today's NFL, you cannot build around some journeyman. And like you said, win games in succession. Can you win one game against those teams? Sure, the Colts beat the Chiefs this year. Who knows how? But can you rattle off a bunch of wins? No chance.
And, like, you know, Denver's defense this year is a great example of just how freaking hard it is to have an amazing defense now. That defense was incredible, but they drop coverage somewhere. Like, you know, one play a game, they get beaten, and that's a touchdown now, and then you don't win the game anymore because your offense stinks. Like, I don't think it has the same impact now that it might have had in 2000 or 2002. I just don't think that's an attainable goal. So if you're not a team looking at the Super Bowl with the sort of starting position of we need an elite quarterback or as close to one as we can get, I don't think you're immediately losing. Like, you're just not on the right pathway, in my opinion.
Look, if you're not going to have one of the elites, they need to be on a rookie contract, right? That right. is then the one way to bridge the gap. You know, Jared Goff 2018, obviously Jalen Hurts this year. I mean, he had a phenomenal Super Bowl performance. But if you're not going to have a Patrick Mahomes or that level of guy, paying a veteran is just, it's just not going to work. You need to then go to the rookie deal and be able to build up the roster around them, spend a ton of money at other positions to kind of, you know, bridge that gap and make up for those deficiencies. Those are the two paths forward right now. I know it sucks to hear, but that's the NFL we're living in these days.
All right, so the Bucs are losing a ton of talent, a ton of snaps to free agency. Who else is hemorrhaging players as we head into this period?
Yeah, well, a bit of a scary one considering how bad they are picking third overall, but Arizona is losing a lot of talent this offseason as well. I also think they're going to probably trade DeAndre Hopkins in the near future, but, you know, Zach Allen and J.J. Watt both departing. Their defensive line wasn't great to begin with. It might be one of the worst in the NFL now with both of those guys on the way out the door. Tennessee losing a lot of players. I think it's more about volume over, you know, like big names, but a lot of important contributors. They obviously rotated through the defensive line a ton. You've got like DeMarcus Walker taking off, you know, guys that made important contributions, linebacker David Long on the way out. And obviously they cut, you know, they saved about $40 million yesterday, cutting a bunch of dudes. And the last one is the New York Giants. You know, obviously Daniel Jones and Saquon Barkley, but also Julian Love has become a really good kind of safety with a little bit of slot capabilities. You know, they're another one that I think, you know, underrated, losing some talent, but, you know, we'll get to it. They also have a lot to spend and a lot of resources available, so that'll help.
What about the flip side? Who is actually not losing much talent at all?
Yep, so the Carolina Panthers, by far the fewest snaps played by pending free agents, which is, of course, a good and a bad thing. You know, it's a good thing that they have a lot of their guys signed. Also, it just shows, you know, they didn't really have a lot of good players, you know, last year, you know, obviously. But, you know, Matt Ioannidis, a good player, you know, missed some time with injury. But, you know, probably the only guy I think is, like, super relevant. Bradley Bozeman, a solid center, but they didn't even start him in week one. He kind of earned it. And then Jacksonville. Look, I mean, they obviously went on their massive spending spree last year. And so all the guys they have outside of a couple guys, Evan Engram, Arden Key, Dwayne Smoot coming off an injury but a free agent. That's pretty much the list. And I think they're going to bring back at least Engram and maybe Engram and Arden Key.
Yeah, which I think both would be pretty smart moves for them. Those two guys, I think, ended up each of them being pretty significant contributors for them. Anyone else relevant from this list that you think is worth bringing up in terms of teams that are losing either a lot or a little to free agency?
Yeah, you know, I don't think you're going to lose a ton of these guys, but, you know, the Niners, they probably could, I think they could lose a lot of these guys because they have to spend internally. I think Nick Bosa is going to get a $30 million per year deal. Ayuk is a fascinating situation now, coming off probably his best year as an NFL player, going into his fifth-year option. Can they also extend him? You know, it's very interesting for them with the guys they are potentially losing, Samson Ebukam, some other players across that roster. Like, do they have the financial flexibility? Yes, they're not spending much at quarterback, so that certainly helps. But a lot of big deals all across that roster. Jimmy Ward probably on the way out. Sounds like he wants to leave at this point. But, you know, they're going to do some interesting retooling in that secondary, and it'll be interesting to see how they kind of recover from losing a lot of players in that secondary.
All right, so let's go on to which teams are actually well-positioned to spend when it gets to free agency. So the salary cap's gone up. It's not the best free agent class in the world. There's actually quite a lot of players, I think, that can be brought in and be solid contributors next year. Who has the space to do it, and who can free up the space to do it? Because that's another element to this, right? It's not just how much salary cap space you have right now, but how much can you actually create if you want to go on this kind of spending spree?
Right, yeah. So my top five for answers both, but probably more so just who has space right now, but they also could clear even more. I mean, the Bears are an obvious one, nearly double the amount of cap space of any other team. They spent the least amount of cash in the NFL last year by a dramatic amount. Actually spent about half the cash the Rams did last year, which is kind of crazy. So Bears, obvious. Atlanta Falcons also just gutted this entire roster, just totally hit the reset button, which I think was smart. I think Matt Ryan, honestly, could have stuck around for one more farewell tour, and it was sort of a blessing in disguise that he got pissed off hearing about the Watson situation and basically demanded they trade him. You know, kind of a blessing in disguise that happened. Right. The Texans also kind of, you know, cleared a bunch of older players off their roster, and I think they're going to have to spend. I mean, you can't – look, I know the ownership knows they were going to have to reset and start over with losing Watson and all that, but you got to be at least, like, relatively competitive in your, third year now for Casario. – And the Patriots, They went on that big spending spree 2 years ago, but I think some of those guys come off the books, or you know, they cut some of those guys and could spend again. And the last one I mentioned, the New York Giants, I think are going to be pretty aggressive in this free agent and trade market coming up this offseason.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, like the Texans with Nick Caserio has been a weird like tenure so far, because I get that they've kind of been treading water until they got rid of Deshaun Watson, but it's difficult to identify a clear pattern to any signings that they've made other than just, you know, we have to do things. We have to bring players. You have to make a 53-man roster. But beyond that, it's like, I don't want to commit anything to any of these guys. We don't want to have long-term deals or long-term money signed up. I'm just like ticking over this roster until we can actually get rid of Watson, then we can start to build something. But now's the time where they actually do need to then start that, right?
Yeah, and the one guy they've kind of done that with is Brandon Cooks, who I'd be surprised if he's on the roster by April 1st. I think he's going to, you know, all but demand a trade, and I think they're going to acquiesce there and give it to him. But, yeah, now is the time. I mean, you need growth from these early draft picks they finally had last year. Obviously not a great start for either guy. Mostly your injuries, not really necessarily bad play from Derek Stingley. But, you know, Kenyon Green obviously needs to take a quantum leap next year to justify that pick at this point. But, yeah, they need to start signing guys to multi-year deals. I think bringing in DeMeco Ryans was maybe the best hire of the cycle, or certainly in the conversation. And I think he's going to say, hey, look, I came here, you know, despite all the reasons I had not to, let's build up this defense, spend on this defense. I actually love their secondary. They have so much diversity back there and can do different things with different skill sets. But hey, this defensive line needs to get much better. Obviously, where he's coming from in San Francisco, that's what it's all about. Could add at linebacker as well. Yeah, I think this is the time where, hey, they got to win at least like 6-7 games next year. Or you start saying, what are we doing? Like you said, what is the direction? What is the path of this team? But I think they will get there. I'm kind of a believer in now they bring in DeMeco Ryans. I think they can figure things out.
And we also collectively have to be believers in the Texans because they signed PFF Bobby Slowick as their offensive coordinator, right? So we have to buy into what the Texans are doing. It's contractually obligated now.
I'm all in. Bobby, I mean, hey, he's going to work with Bryce Young, ideally, at least in my opinion, and get this team back on track.
Why can't Brandon Cook stay in any one place for more than like a couple of years? Why is this guy constantly just bounced around the league, consistently doing well for any offense, and then immediately shipped off for a first-round pick subsequently?
The funny thing is he wanted to like truly plant roots and be in Houston. He said, I never want to get traded again. When he signed his deal, that was still the plan. And I guess he thought, for whatever reason, that they were going to be more competitive and actually try to win games and maybe sign a head coach that got him more excited than a couple of older vets that, you know, I'm sure he didn't love and wanted to get like a guy like it to DeMeco. Hey, maybe they try to sell him on this new vision. But I think at this point, he wants to just go somewhere to contend. But the question's like, I think he's a great locker room guy. I think he's a great leader. I think honestly, in the early stages, it was just, he was kind of in this weird tweener spot of like, he's a really, really, really good player, but probably wants like top of market money. And maybe he's viewed like just below that. And it was hard to kind of bridge that gap.
What about teams that don't have any kind of spending room and are basically going to be bystanders while this happens?
You know, obviously, you know, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I'd be surprised if they do anything meaningful in free agency. New Orleans Saints, I think, you know, especially they bring in Derek Carr, that's probably going to be the most of what they do. Minnesota is an underrated bad situation. I mean, their roster is old, relatively bloated with some older contracts, and unless they cut a bunch of those guys, you know, you're still trying to replace good players, and so it's going to be tough. Like Thielen and Harrison Smith, they're not the same they were, but if you cut them, are you going to find a better player, you know, on free agency for cheap? Probably not. Those ones are the big ones, and the Chargers too. I mean, they need to just win with the core they have right now. They don't have a clear path to creating a ton of space. They don't have a ton of space to begin with. I guess I shout this out now. I had an article come out today, the five teams with the least cap space and how they can create enough room to make some moves. The Chargers, it's not a good situation in Los Angeles.
Yeah, so when you start reading out these names, certainly the Saints are obviously the poster boy for years of the team to kind of treat the salary cap like a credit card, right? We rack up the giant bill and then we pay it off with some fairly severe cuts just before the deadline, and that's kind of how they approach it. The Vikings, I think, do it in a vaguely similar way, quite like a less severe manner, but generally their approach tends to be similar. Like, how much of this is these teams, they're going to make some pretty aggressive moves, and then they usually have the spending room at the end of that for, you know, a couple of significant signings and then a bunch of other guys coming in to fix the holes that they just created by paying off that credit card. And then the other part of that, specifically for the Vikings, actually for the Saints as well, when you change the regime, right, does that, like, who dictates that approach? Is it the general manager? Is it the guy that you have sort of operating the salary cap? Because the Vikings have had that same guy, Rob Brzezinski or whatever his name is, since like the late 90s. So is he the guy setting this approach, or, you know, Rick Spielman to Kwesi, the whole financial system is going to change and they're going to approach the salary cap in a completely different way going forward?
Shout out Rob Brzezinski, great guy. Realistically, for most buildings, it is the GM comes to you and says, here's what we're doing. Here's around where it's going to cost. They will take the cap guy's valuation into account to a degree. You go figure it out. I don't really care how you fit it on the books. It's just, here's what we're spending. You make it work on the salary cap. So I wouldn't say that it's, you know, for him or anyone else, like, it's their idea, their strategy. They obviously have kind of what they believe in. Are they more of a proration heavy team? Do they want to pay more year to year? That kind of trickles down from the owner as well. So yeah, it's their general construct or their idea. But realistically, if the GM tells you, hey, we're adding these players and you need to find a way to make it work, and we want to balance the, you know, the years in such a way, it's your job then to just figure out how to massage those numbers so that, you know, maybe there's different higher hits for a certain player in a certain year, and then it drops another year and other players go up and so on and so forth. So yeah, long answer short, it's the GM, it's probably the coach, honestly, more than the GM in a lot of buildings as well, and then the cap guys just got to figure it out.
When it comes to ownership, sort of making suggestions or determinations on that kind of approach, what is the driving force behind that? Are there genuinely kind of cash-strapped owners who just don't have the money to play the cap in a certain way? Or, like, what is the... Because we tend to work on this basis, theoretically, that, like, all owners are in it for the same thing. They want to win. They'll do whatever it takes. There's general sort of differences of spending and et cetera, but it's not, we don't sort of think of it relative to the salary cap necessarily, but, like, what is the restricting factor on owners that want to play it a different way?
Yeah, no, the restriction is cash, and there are very different tiers. I mean, you look at the legacy owners, the family-run businesses, again, our hometown Cincinnati Bengals, Las Vegas Raiders, Los Angeles Chargers. They don't want to and can't really spend as much cash as the other teams. And like I said, the Rams, you know, spent about double the Bears last year. You know, the Saints are always, they do this because they don't have a problem spending a ton of cash. What you're doing when you push cap down the road is enabling yourself to spend more cash in the present year than the actual salary cap. And you can do that, you know, for a long time. Like you said, it is a credit card. Eventually it's going to eat at you. But I mean, the Eagles, again, had the most prorated money in the NFL this year, even with a rookie contract quarterback. Obviously, a lot of that tied into, I mean, you know, Carson Wentz had, you know, dead cap hits, Brandon Brooks, all these guys. But yes, you know, I know fans, I want to hear this. There are profit-maximizing owners and there are win-maximizing owners, and they operate in kind of different ballparks in what they're able to do and or what they want to do.
Because that's the thing that's never made any sense to me, is that even these legacy owners, like, the NFL is a money-printing machine. Like, the entire thing is like a tax write-off, right? So that the whole thing is like a scam relative to how everybody else, the rest of us, have to earn money and pay taxes on it and all that kind of stuff. So even if you didn't have the money to begin with, like, if you weren't a Stan Kroenke or whatever and walked into this thing with billions already and just put your billions to work with the team or the Walton family or whatever, even if you started off with your wealth came from the inherited team that you got given, like, it only creates wealth in itself. So you would think at this point, anybody that's owned a team through legacy means would just have accumulated enough wealth to make it work however they wanted to make it work at this point. But is it a case of, like, those guys could, but they, you know, they use the money in other ways, and they're not necessarily inclined to sink it all back right into the team every year?
You are printing money. You're going to be profitable every year. You're going to generate a ton of revenue every year. But I think the misnomer is, like the valuations of clubs is really where like their growth has been, right? The equity they have in the team, and the, you know, the team's going from, you know, Robert Kraft bought his team for like $100 million in 1999 or whatever the story is.
Right.
It's now worth probably $6-7 billion. Like for the legacy owners, like they don't want to take out loans against that or use their ownership as collateral, right? So it's a different thing than having actual liquid cash on hand that you can spend. Again, to a degree, they do have it. And it's not like they're poor and can't spend, you know, a good amount. Obviously, the Raiders, I mean, spent a ton of money last year and tried to here and there. Mark Davis, is a legacy owner that, you know, we hear stories about when he has to sell or when he has to, you know, when family dies in certain situations and they have to pay off, like, the estate tax, it creates a huge issue because they don't have the cash on hand, those things. It's a real concern. I mean, the Walmart money coming in now, they're operating in a different, you know, realm than some of these other teams.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, their sort of starting financial position is multiple times X over the next richest owner. Like they're in a completely different world if they in terms of how they want to spend the money, if indeed they do want to spend it that way.
And I think the thing too is, of course, mainly we're talking about players and all that, but and you're seeing it now in Carolina. I think Tepper finally realized. I mean, he did spend way more on a first-time head coach than any team ever had before. He pissed off a lot of owners with the Matt Rhule contract. But again, also, the Eagles, again, I mean, having Vic Fangio on staff, giving a new contract just for the Super Bowl, you know, paying all these guys to come in and be coordinators and whatever. And now you look at Carolina, our guy Dom Capers with, you know, great set of hair on him. And they obviously bring in Ajiro Averro. They make all these moves to compete in coaching, in front office, and all these other areas that, again, look, there was a story, you know, the Chargers defensive coordinator, Ronaldo Hill, is now the, I think, defensive passing game coordinator or something like that in Miami. I don't know this for a fact. I wouldn't be surprised if he's making more money in Miami at a lower position than he was in Los Angeles. For example, Vic Fangio, now the Dolphins defensive coordinator, he's probably making more money than Brandon Staley is as the head coach of the Chargers on an annual basis. Like, those are, again, things that, look, they make a big difference. A talent does run the league. It matters more than anything else, no question about it. But if you're spending on great scouts and personnel guys and coaches, position coaches, all the way down the list, it's going to have a tangible impact in the win-loss column.
I've said that for years, that, like, obviously there's a salary cap, and we've talked about the various ways that restricts you from on-field talent. But there's a ton of ways that if you actually want to deploy Walton money, like if you want to make that a weapon and use that as a way that you can beat other teams – you can go and spend more than every other team in the NFL at a bunch of things that make a really big difference to how your team is going to do, like, you know, assembling an all-star coaching staff, if that's what you want to do, and say, all right, you were earning whatever being a defensive coordinator or even a head coach at a different team. I'm going to make you something lower, but I'm going to pay you three times more because I can. Like, that would make a huge difference. Other than, you know, the stuff you just talked about, generally speaking, that doesn't happen. How much of that is like peer pressure from the other owners saying, like, dude, rein it in. Like, let's not go crazy here. There's 32 of us. Let's not turn this into a crazy arms race. We have a good thing going here.
Exactly right. It is, you know, collusion to a degree, not to use that word as some like massive, you know, whatever. But that is what it is, right? I mean, if it wasn't, some team would have offered to pay Bill Belichick $50 million a year a long time ago, right? I mean, he's making 20 or in that range and is probably still the highest paid coach in the NFL. But yeah, the other owners have enough pressure to say, let's not compete in areas we don't necessarily need to compete in. But some owners, like I said, Tepper said, I don't care. I want to win. And I have a bunch of billions, so I'm going to do that regardless. I mean, it's funny, like, him coming from Pittsburgh, where he was a minority owner, to now Carolina. Pittsburgh doesn't compete in that area in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
I mean, to their credit, they've been obviously incredibly successful for my entire lifetime, so maybe they don't need to. But yeah, it is the owners kind of saying, hey, let's not – because, hey, I guess you could argue, hey, once we start doing that, it's a slippery slope. Because there's no cap on it, It could then get crazy. But the smart teams are definitely maneuvering around that.
Yeah, look, Steve's not on the show, so I thought our chances of getting sued actually went down. You can't be throwing around words like collusion when he's not there. All right, let's drag this back to the free agent class. We said before, it's not a great group, but it's not there aren't that many guys that are going to get hit with the franchise tag. But where is it strong and where is it weak, relatively speaking?
Yep. So I think the big one for me, and I mentioned Deron Payne, which hurts us a little bit, but interior defensive line, I think, is one of the better free agent class we've seen in a long time. Obviously, Javon Hargrave in Philadelphia, I think, might hit the free agent market and not get a new deal from them. They're not going to franchise tag him, but not get a new deal from them. And then you have guys like Draymond Jones in Denver. I mentioned Zach Allen with the Cardinals, Dalvin Tomlinson in Minnesota. There's kind of – those are all different blends, too, right? You have some nose tackles, some, 3-4 defensive ends, like a lot of different styles, true three techs, pass rushers, run defenders, all these different things. I think it's a great class. Running back is one of the best we've ever seen. It really does start to look like Saquon Barkley might be hitting the open market. You can make an argument he's one of the best running backs to hit the market in a very long time. I do think Jacobs gets tagged, but nevertheless, like a really good and deep class. Miles Sanders, Devin Singletary, David Montgomery, you can go on forever. Different styles, pass catchers, more pure early down runners, so on and so forth. And then the last one is off-ball linebacker. Very, very yes. strong. Again, there's your speedy, undersized coverage players. There are your, big body Leighton Vander Esch, Tremaine Edmonds type of guys. Any style of linebacker you want and any system you want, there's an expensive option, a mid-tier option, a cheap option. It's a great class this year for off-ball linebacker.
And this, again, feels like a bit of a trend of teams getting better at this. Like, the two positions where I would say this class is the strongest are running back and off-the-ball linebacker, which are two positions that we would sort of generally decree you don't want to spend a ton of money. You don't want to invest in that. It's not the high value impact position where you want to throw a lot of money on your roster. You want to try and find cheaper, good players at that position. Is this a product of that? Because I'm curious what you think these contracts are going to look like at these positions that are suddenly massively abundant, but positions that you would generally advocate not to spend money in.
110%. I mean, the market correction has happened. It could continue. I think we're almost near an inflection point where maybe it's kind of settled. But, I mean, you have guys, Aaron Jones, you could argue, signing for $12 million a year a couple of years ago was arguably a little bit below market if you were looking from the lens of, the markets always rise. We have these top deals at 16 and 15 million for, McCaffrey, Elliott-type players. Not only does he sign for $12 million a year, he then takes a $5 million pay cut
right.
this offseason. And I think, look, the Cowboys are either going to get a pay cut out of Zeke or he's going to be gone. I think Cincinnati at least explores the conversation. Minnesota probably explores the conversation, with Mixon and Dalvin Cook. We've seen a true market reset there. And I think Nick Chubb is kind of a catalyst as well, signing a 3-year deal for about $36.6 million. For me, that was like, we're not like a running back may not surpass Christian McCaffrey's contract for years, right? Yeah. And again, like obviously we advocate for those things. I'm not saying we advocate for guys not to get paid, but we obviously said there was probably too much of a percentage of cap expenditure at this position compared to the on-field value of the players. That one's happened. Linebacker, I think it's more, and I think it applies to safety as well, where if you're not one of the top guys, the mid-tier market has kind of evaporated, right? Like, instead of there being, all right, I think Tremaine Edmonds is still going to get like $18 million a year. I think someone is going to break him off and give him a huge bag. But beyond that, instead of there being the 13, 14 guys and then the 8, 9 guys, there's just a ton of like $6, $7 million a year guys. Safety, same thing. Like, you just, unless you're one of those premier guys, it's no longer gradual. It's just you're top or you're not.
I also wonder with linebacker whether teams are starting to treat it as it's not a foundational piece. It's a piece you add once you're already good. It's sort of the sequence of where you put it in the construction of this, this house that you're building. It's not the foundation slab. It's not the chimney. Like, it's some kind of decorative thing that you put on after the fact, which can make a really big difference. We've seen that Roquan Smith in Baltimore is very different to Roquan Smith in Chicago. And to an extent, that makes a lot of sense for Baltimore, even if maybe they're suffering for that with Lamar Jackson's contract or whatever. But it's a very different value proposition depending on what the rest of the roster looks like. So I think there are teams that it makes no sense whatsoever to go and invest big money into a linebacker. But there are other teams where you can say, all right, that team around this guy is good enough that I think it certainly makes more sense.
Fred Warner is one of the more impactful players in the NFL, but like you're saying, if you didn't have Nick Bosa, Eric Armstead, and all these dudes in front of him, do you then are you starting with a Fred Warner, or is it more smart to build up that defensive line and then throw in, you know, the best coverage linebacker in the NFL that can play sideline to sideline, do everything? Then it makes a ton of sense. I agree. Whereas, you know, again, I mentioned my Bears fanhood. You know, we still think that Mike linebacker is the foundation of the defense and how you should start building. That's not the reality of the NFL at all anymore.
Right. What about where does this free agent class really stink?
Yeah, so the two big ones are wide receiver and cornerback. You know, receiver, obviously, there's been some good classes in the past couple of years. I mentioned how all the guys that could have been free agents just went ahead and got extended. It's just not a good class. There's a bunch of number twos. You know, Jacoby Myers, DJ Chark, Alan Lazard. You know, I kind of think he's like more of a number three realistically on a good team. But nevertheless, like, there's a bunch of like solid secondary options, but it's just not a good class compared to years past. And then corner as well. There was a bunch of great corners the last couple of years. Obviously, you know, we had guys like Shaq Griffin, William Jackson, Carlton Davis, you know, a bunch of like names, you know, borderline number ones, maybe better fit as number twos, but good players. And this year, it's realistically, it's like Jamel Dean, drop, Rockyasin, drop, Byron Murphy, and then you're signing like 30-year-olds. Like, that's the class.
Yeah, there's a lot of 30-year-olds this year for some reason for cornerbacks.
Yeah, it's an old class. And so that's the thing, too, is that, you know, edge defenders kind of the same. Also a pretty weak group. I mentioned Marcus Davenport, who's our number one free agent. And, yes, he's a phenomenal player. Comes up, you know, top 15 for us in pass rush win rate, pressure percentage, all that. He's also never played 600 snaps in a season. Yeah. And then it's like, you know, again, great players, but Justin Houston, Melvin Ingram, Brandon Graham, those guys aren't just 30. They're like 33, 34. Again, in free agency, we shouldn't always be looking to add this 25-year-old foundational piece. If they were that good, they probably wouldn't be a free agent. You know, you want to add these mid-tier guys, maybe some veterans and stuff like that. But again, when we're grading the class, we recognize like these are 1 or 2 year solutions, you know, ideally.
I mean, I think that's definitely a trend since, I mean, you don't have to go back that far, where like teams are just so much better now at preventing really, really good players hitting free agency. Those guys teams are better at managing the cap, like top to bottom. They just understand when these guys are going to come up and how to keep them around. You don't have to go back that far where I think teams were just collectively awful at managing the salary cap, and like an amazing player coming up for free agency would just like torpedo their entire plan, and amazing guys were hitting free agency on a fairly regular basis because the planning was that bad.
I think 110%. And I mentioned earlier, but I think the biggest thing is, and you could honestly credit players more for pushing towards this as well, but is honestly the teams realizing it's not worth taking the risk of, all right, we signed this guy early and maybe he's not worth as much as we gave him and it's kind of a bad deal. That risk is worth taking compared to, let's let this guy play his contract out, hope he has a bad contract here. Like, that's your plan.
Right.
And then obviously every team only has one tag at their disposal. So if you have multiple players, you're going to lose one of them in theory. And yes, we're seeing more and more teams go the early extension round. I mentioned the Eagles, but you know, the Bills used to not really do it. Now they're doing it a ton. And you know, they've had some injuries, but like Deion Dawkins and Tre'Davious White and Matt Milano, like those deals are phenomenal compared to if they let them go to hit the market the year later. More and more teams are doing that. I you know, Pittsburgh doing it with Deontay Johnson. Yes, it was a 2-year deal, but like they don't really do that unless it's a quarterback or TJ Watt, right? Like they really try to avoid. Even Minkah Fitzpatrick had to get the end of his deal going into the 5th-year option, even though they trade a 1st-round pick away. That's the thing too, and I think it's partly, you know, credit to the players and their agents, but also teams just making that proposition of,
yeah,
we'd rather take this risk, sign a guy to a multi-year deal, an extension, and then the beauty of it is, I mean, you look, I think the biggest one I always point to is like Danielle Hunter and Stephon Diggs signing these deals after 3 years in Minnesota, and both of them were infinitely better than their contract the next season, right? And it's like,
yeah,
of course, Diggs pushes for a trade and all those things happen. Hunter's still on that deal, but that'll end this offseason. He'll get a new contract. But the surplus value potential there is enormous, as opposed to playing the franchise tag game, letting them hear offers from the open market. And I think teams have kind of figured that out.
I was going to say, they've almost gotten too good at it, where you sign these guys to these deals, which are almost immediately absurd looking. And then that just pisses the player off who wants to agitate for more money, having just signed the deal that is a bargain from the team's point of view. And I think Minnesota has had that for a few of these guys, and they're not the only ones. Like, there are teams that are signing these guys to a deal that's almost immediately absurdly below market value, and you're almost doing it so well that you just create a rod for your own back when that player starts to renegotiate again as quick as humanly possible. Let's wrap this up with a look back a year ago to some of the best and the worst free agent signings that year. So weirdly, obviously some of them, you know, you could see coming. Some of them made a lot of sense at the time. But obviously some of the best are the ones that just the guy came out of nowhere, with Geno Smith being the most obvious. Like, you know, somebody posted on Twitter yesterday, what's the most ridiculous offseason rumor from a year ago with hindsight? And it was that Geno Smith would start, be really good, which some people did say. We had a bet on the show from a guy saying that Geno Smith would rank in the top 25% of all quarterbacks in the NFL over the season. And we were like, yeah, absolutely, we'll take that bet. That's ridiculous. There's no way that happens. And we did that after the preseason where he looked really good. We were like, there's still no chance in hell. That means he's going to be a top 10 quarterback. Never going to happen. And then Geno has the season that he has it. So obviously that deal, 1 year, $3.5 million or whatever, looks like an absolute, it's like one of the best quarterback value contracts in the league.
Best values for a single year maybe of all time. I mean, it's just a crazy, crazy situation. It does also show you that people love calling guys busts and whatnot. Player development and proper usage of players, it matters a ton. And you know, it's not just the player themselves. Of course, they have to be committed. You know, I think Geno himself would probably admit his Jets tenure wasn't, you know, just the Jets' fault. Right. I think he should bear some blame there as well. But anyway, yeah, some of the best signings. Obviously, Geno's on that list. Looking into guys that, like, we already knew were good but just got great deals. For me, Hassan Reddick was so fascinating because he had double-digit sacks in back-to-back seasons before coming into this free agency. And if there's one thing we know, it's that teams are going to overpay for sack production. But, you know, not a team like Philadelphia, a smart team that doesn't fall for those traps. For him to still only sign 3-year, $45 million, $30 million in total guarantees, I think it's almost exclusively because – he's undersized, and he kind of, you know, hadn't played edge rusher until the back half of 2020, and then obviously most of last year. But it's just crazy. Also, the first round draft capital, of course, always inflates deals to a degree. So, you know, that one is an obvious one. I think Stephon Gilmore, yes, the Colts were not very good, but, you know, a great signing for them. It was had a great year. Their defense was good. I mean, they were top half of the NFL against the pass. They just really, you know, couldn't do – they were dead last in e-paper play on offense. That'll kill you every time. James Bradbury also in Philadelphia. DJ Reed with the Jets was a phenomenal signing as well at outside corner. And another edge defender too. And a one that, you know, I frankly admittedly did not love at the time. Once the details came out, it made a little bit more sense. But – so Darius Smith to Minnesota on a 3-year, $42 million deal. It was, if he didn't play well, it would have been a 1-year, about $10 million deal, and they would have moved on. But, you know, now I think he obviously will stick around, had a great year for them as well. So those are some of the best deals, and all those guys made huge impacts above the contract they signed.
Yeah, Gilmore quietly had a really good season for them. Like, that was a big bounce back year for him when I think a lot of people probably thought he was washed up at this point. So that's a pretty fascinating one. What about some of the worst spent money last year?
Yeah, I think it's an easy answer for my least favorite contract, and that's Chandler Jones to the Las Vegas Raiders. A guy that had already had a couple injury things. He has been a remarkably durable player, but missed some time, and then he had like 6 sacks in 2021, but 5 of them came in week 1 against Taylor Lewan coming off an ACL tear, you know, and who admittedly says, like, I was, you know, just in the spin cycle. And then he pretty much didn't do anything after that. 3 years, $51 million is pretty much what Von Miller signed for. I know that 6 years, $120 million. He basically signed a 3-year deal for $52.5 million. And then it's kind of like, we'll figure out from there, especially now, unfortunately, you know, tearing the ACL. He obviously was great before that, but so you're basically giving the same contract to Chandler Jones, and he did nothing until the last couple weeks of the year. When he's playing opposite, you know, one of the best young edge rushers in the entire NFL, Max yeah. Crosby, and still kind of did nothing. Another one, Cedric Wilson, a bizarre one in Miami, 3 years, $22 million, basically didn't play. Like, Trent Sherfield came up from San Francisco with Mike McDaniel, and just earn the number three job. I think he was a good number three. He's a good run blocker. Had a couple awesome snags this year, honestly. One got stolen by a penalty that should have been one of the touchdowns of the year, or stolen by a missed call. But yeah, Cedric Wilson for 3 years, 22, and the guy doesn't even get the field. Not great. And then, you know, you got to mention it. Yes, injuries were a part of it, but, you know, J.C. Jackson for 5 years, $82.5 million, $40 million in total guarantees. Even before the injury, he was our lowest graded corner in the entire NFL. He had the worst yards per coverage snap in the NFL before he ultimately was lost for the year, in part also because, look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to say it's an easy job, but he comes in, passes the physical, all that, and then it comes out that he needs to get like a surgery on his ankle or his foot or whatever it was before the season even began, and it was obviously all downhill from there.
It also looked like he couldn't play in the type of scheme that they wanted him playing in, and it wasn't until almost immediately before he got injured for the season that they changed what they were asking him to do, which feels like a fairly questionable, like, kind of pro-scouting process. Like, you bring this guy in from New England expecting him to do a completely different thing than he did there, and he's awful at it, albeit with the kind of confounding factors of the injury, et cetera. And then you finally kind of flip him back to something more akin to what he was doing in New England. He looked better and then immediately gets injured and he's lost for the year. So we don't know if it would have worked out or not. But like the whole concept of let's bring a guy in, ask him to do something dramatically different to what he was doing in the past and hope that works and attach, you know, $40 million guaranteed dollars to it feels like quite questionable process.
Not probably going to be a winning strategy. Most of the time, and obviously it was not the case here.
And I say that with like the caveat that I would put on is I kind of agreed with them. Like theoretically, I thought Jackson should have been good at that stuff, given what his skill set has actually been and where he thrives. He just really wasn't. So maybe the injury was a really big part of that, and maybe he can be good in this scheme. But like, as of right now, that looks like one of the most disastrous signings that's been made in the last few years.
It really does. I mean, they could, in theory, get out. There's only guaranteed money going through this upcoming season. It would take some dead cap from the $25 million signing bonus. But, yeah, it's just – and, again, I mentioned at the top of the show talking about teams in a tough situation. Like, if they want to clear cap and add talent, like, restructuring a guy like J.C. Jackson is one of the options available. Restructuring Khalil Mack, who's 32. Restructuring Corey Linsley, who's 32. Like, those are their avenues. That's why you're hearing about, like, Keenan Allen getting cut or traded. He's owed $19 million next year. He honestly was phenomenal once he got healthy from week 11 through the end of the season. He averaged 10 targets, 8 catches, and about 80 yards receiving. Like, he was very good, but that's why you're hearing that, because they just don't have a lot of pass forward, and that's before we even get into, you know, Justin Herbert getting a monstrous new deal, you know, probably this offseason.
All right, any other closing thoughts about this upcoming free agent group before we get out of here?
Yeah, you know, I would just say, making my pitch for why people should care and get into it, like I said, maybe there are these flashy names, but there are going to be a lot of players that make an impact, mid-tier guys, rotational players that are going to come available. And I think we will be talking next offseason, say, hey, look, you know, it wasn't the sexiest group of names, but a lot of players that made big impact. So I would keep an eye on it. Like I said, if you want to know what your team's going to be doing in the draft, or they're going to target certain positions and whatnot, that all starts on March 15th.
Yeah, it actually, in a funny way, it feels like this is a year for smart teams to do really well, because like last year, right, Cincinnati understood they had a massive hole in the offensive line. They understood they needed to fix it, and they weren't going to go crazy with giant money on one dude. So they went and sort of did the smart money deals, bringing in Alex Kappa, Ted Karras, and really did a great job overhauling that offensive line. Like the entire free agent class this year is like Alex Kappa's and Ted Karras's. Like that's who this group is at every position. So teams that need those players, like just a capable starter to solve a problem of need, are going to be able to do a lot of work without spending a lot of money and dramatically change their fortunes going forward.
The way you win in free agency is either you spend on a secondary or tertiary player at the premium positions, or you spend on the non-premium positions and you're not breaking the bank. But like you said, you're getting an immediate, if not impact starter, at least above average starter. That's how you do it. You know, you said the good teams, the smart teams, that's what they've been doing, and that's how you truly win.
And as much as the combine is all about, you know, athletic timing and the draft, it's also when all of this starts. you know, not legally, because the legal tampering period is only, whatever it is, 48 hours before the start of the real one, but it's when it really starts. All the conversations in Indy, in Prime, in the Starbucks, in the just the corridors of the convention center, this is when the business starts for real.
Absolutely. That's when the chatter starts and you start to get a gauge of kind of what your market is. Yeah, no one's tampering. No one's breaking any rules. But, you know, you learn some things.
Perfect. All right, Brad, thanks very much. This is one of our most requested repeats from last year. You were your show last year was a big hit. So we thank you very much for coming back on. We'll have to get you back on sometime during the whole free agent chaos itself when it kicks off in earnest.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Take it easy, guys. We will be back, myself and Steve, tomorrow. So take it easy. Bye-bye.